All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to this public lecture on the new minority, white working-class politics in an era of immigration and inequality. My name is Eiko Thielemann. I'm the director of the LSE Migration Studies Unit. The unit tries to coordinate immigration-related research activities and public events across LSE. And I'm particularly delighted that we're able to welcome today Professor Justin Guest, who was a co-founder of the LSE Migration Studies Unit when he was doing his PhD here at LSE in the government department a few years ago. I was not supposed to be on the podium. Unfortunately, our chair has been delayed by the train service. So I will just do the introductions, and then somewhere in the middle of the event, I will hand over to the rightful chair, Eric Hoffman from the University of Birkbeck, who will be leading you through the event. The talk today, of course, could not be more topical if one tried. I'm extremely excited that we had a good turnout despite the weather. The proceedings will be as follows. Justin Guest will lead us off, introduce the new book, then we will have two discussants. Dame Margaret Hodge in the middle, who is a Labour MP for Barking and also an alumni from of the London School of Economics. She also served as Minister for Children and Minister of State for Culture and Tourism, as well as Chairman of the Public Accounts Committee. Her remarks will be complemented also by Stephen Kinnock, who is also a Labour MP, and I will make sure that the Chair, when he arrives, will also leave plenty of time for question and answers, discussion, and comments later on. So, Justin, if you want to start us off, and then I'll invite the discussants to make their remarks before, hopefully, Eric Hoffman by then will open it up for discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. Very excited to be here. For many, many years, I've watched many lectures from those seats and also from the seats at the old theater. And it is very exciting and a little bit nerve-wracking to be in front of all of you on the other side of things. It's very thrilling. And I'm also very much honored to be joined by Eiko Thielemann, who I've worked with extensively over the course of my young career, Dame Margaret, and also Stephen Kinnock, who is really an honor to have them be interested in this subject matter, but really they are as equally qualified to discuss this matter as representatives of very large white working class constituencies over the years and have so much to say. So thank you very much for being here. I want to start off with the premise of the book that I've just published, The New Minority, to start things. And that is that the center, the middle of our politics, has fallen out. And we are really not quite sure how to get back to the large centrist coalitions that engendered progress over the history of our societies. And for many people, this falling out of the center in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and elsewhere in Europe, this polarization, is explained in a lot of different ways. So for one group of people, this is simply the media's fault. It's sensationalized, it has a voracious appetite for controversy, and it simply likes polarization because it sells. Another side will say, and particularly in the United States, where I come from, that a lot of this is driven by campaign finance reform and the need for it, because the United States money is very, very much tied to political power. And when you have conflict, that's when you raise money. You don't raise money when there's agreement, because there's no opposition to support or to oppose. A third group of people will say that actually it's neither the media and it's nor the nature of campaign finance, but actually it's the electoral institutions that matter. And that means that the way our electoral systems are built drives people to the fringe, particularly on the European continent. This is true. where you have proportionate representation. In other words, if 6% of the voters vote for a certain party, then they receive 6% of the seats. Well, when you have that kind of system, people are more willing to vote for far-right parties, for fringe parties and third parties. But the United Kingdom and the United States don't have those systems. They have different systems that I think are important in other ways, and I'll explain that later. I don't disagree with any of these perspectives, but I want to add a fourth narrative, one that I think is very important, and it's about demography. My argument is that white working class people, who used to be the bellwether, the center of politics, and used to hold that center together, have drifted further and further and further to the fringe. Their numbers are smaller. They feel marginalized, and they have moved to the periphery, leaving the center open, a vacuum there, and the parties and the mainstream parties and candidates are still recalibrating just what to do to find those centrist coalitions that bring progress with them. So, my presentation today is going to go as follows. First, I want to introduce you to the two communities that I got to know very, very well as part of my research for this book. The first is Youngstown, Ohio. And you're seeing a lot of images of Youngstown behind me right now, actually. It's an old rubber and tire factory. And there's lots. We could do a lecture just narrating the photos. The second is just down the road from here, Barking and Dagenham, the London borough of Barking and Dagenham, just to the east of the East End. So I'll introduce those two, and I'm actually going to give you oral histories. And the reason why I want to share oral histories is because I want you to hear what my subjects were hearing from their moms and dads, from their nans, from their neighbors, so that you are also in with that history too. And then I'm going to answer three questions. First, is white working class marginality a transatlantic phenomenon? Or is the election of Donald Trump this rogue, extraordinary encounter? Brexit, this strange occurrence in the history of Britain? Or is this actually part of a greater phenomenon? Second, is white working class angst simply racism? Third, and finally, perhaps why many of you are here, what drives white working class people to vote for the far right? All right. So let's get started. First, let me bring you to Youngstown, Ohio. Youngstown, Ohio used to be Steel Town, USA. For a very long period of time in the mid-20th century, Youngstown was the Silicon Valley of the manufacturing era. People from every corner of Europe, from every corner of the world, really, flocked to Youngstown in order to take advantage of the jobs that were amply provided, 9 to 5, 5 to 11, three shifts a day. Youngstown has a skyline untouched by modernism. It has a 20,000-seat football stadium. It has a world-class American museum of art. It has an auditorium that's built in neoclassical architecture. It has a park, Idora Park, built by Frederick Law Olmsted, who is the gentleman who built Central Park in New York City. This is a real city. And for a very long time, it was an important part of the United States economy. It was dominated by the chimney stacks that pumped out black soot into the air, and it would drizzle down onto people's windshields of their cars, onto their patios and porches, and they would sweep it off and wipe it off the windshield and say, pay dirt. Because there's a big-time economy there, and when that black soot was on your windshield, you knew the mills were pumping and percolating and bringing in money. It was a white working-class haven. The mills brought about a rhythm to society, a rhythm to life. They funded newsletters, bowling tournaments, picnics, and family services. And this was a largely middle-class town with those incomes for people who didn't necessarily have a university education, who weren't trained, but were able to bring home a good salary without that much training, without having to work more than one job, and often without necessarily having a spouse who worked as well. It was a different time. And then in 1977, September 19th, a day now called Black Monday, the first steel mill shut its doors, locked out its employees, never to open again. And that set into motion a string of closures across the Mahoning Valley where Youngstown was based. One after another, a steel mill shut, and then the surrounding businesses that supported the mills shut with them. And a way of life began to deteriorate. Domestic abuse cases began to rise. Divorce rates skyrocketed. Suicide rates were among the highest in the United States. And finally, by the early 1990s, Youngstown, Ohio had the highest murder rate in the United States of America. Today, Youngstown, when seen from the sky, has patchy green pastures around the center of the city, where houses once stood. Those houses were either burnt down by their owners to collect on the insurance because they had lost so much value, or they were purposefully demolished by the government because the owners had abandoned them and they had been left to become heroin dens and bordellos. Today, cars drive through the center of Youngstown under dangling traffic lights, like submarines exploring an oxidized Atlantis of rust. Youngstown is a shadow, a shell of what it used to be. And the white working class people that once lived there have largely moved out. A city that was once 170,000 people strong and far larger in the counties surrounding it is a third of its demographic size. Now, today, black people, African Americans, represent about half of the city. And it's not that black people didn't leave. They left too, but they just didn't leave as fast as the white working class people did. And so now demographic change has taken place alongside the economic transformations that have dictated the course of life for this city. Okay, now let's move across the Atlantic over here. Barking and Dagenham was built, really began to be built, in the early 20th century. And it was suburban-like at the time. It was a garden city. There are privet hedges, grassy center medians. The tube went out there. There are picket fences. It was verdant. And it was a wonderful respite from the congestion of central London. And when big factories began to emerge there, you had the May and Baker Chemical Factory, the Barking Power Station, and then eventually the Ford Motor Company, which eventually employed 55,000 people. When they moved out there, white working class people, largely from London's East End, Cockneys, saw an opportunity to escape the congestion of central London, saw an opportunity to improve their state of being, to have a backyard, a garden, to have a little bit of property, and sometimes even detached houses. So they went in droves. And this was also a white working class haven, with the same picnics and newsletters and football tournaments that bring communities together. And like Youngstown, Ohio, the factories and the economy that once brought prosperity to Barking and Dagenham also began to shut, move jobs offshore. Today, the Ford Motor Company factory that once employed 55,000 people now employs 4,000 people. And now that's not just because they've shut down operations in Britain. It's also because so much of their work has become mechanized and robotic. Simply not needed anymore to have 55,000 people working there. But unlike Youngstown, Ohio, as the economic transformation took place in Barking and Dagenham, new life was breathed into it by the conurbation of Greater London. Greater London expanded to embrace Barking and Dagenham into this global city. And immigrants taking advantage of the cheaper housing in the outer boroughs, began to flock. And they were sold, the homes, by white working class people who could afford or who owned their homes and who were moving out of the city. So, demographic change also took hold in Barkey and Dagenham. And now, about 50% of the area is white working class, and the other 50% is this melange of Greater London. You have sub-Saharan Africans, you have Eastern Europeans, you have South Asians, many of whom are Muslim, you have Afro-Caribbeans. Greater London became Barking and Dagenham. Barking and Dagenham became Greater London. But the point is that times have changed greatly. And the white working class people who were left there, chose to remain, could get out, whatever the circumstances may be, feel a remarkable sense of marginality. You might say, and they do, that they feel like a minority in the country that they once defined. So, how do we understand white working class minority, minoritization, marginality? I think there are three key components. The first, and remember, I'm the messenger, so if you disagree with these thoughts, that's okay, you're allowed to, but these are the perceptions of my subjects, and perceptions in politics are more important than reality, as I'm sure you've grown to understand.
That's right.
So the first perception that underpins this sense of marginality is a sense that white working class people have become outnumbered. They feel like a minority, a numerical minority, in societies where they actually are clearly a numerical majority. But from the perch of white working class people in Barkey and Dagenham, in Youngstown, Ohio, they have only seen their numbers relatively shrink. Second, the second aspect of white working class marginality is a sense of externality. They see the government as separate from themselves. They don't feel represented by it. They don't see government as an expression or a representation of who they are. In Barkey and Dagenham in particular, government is viewed as this essential entity in their worlds, but as this faceless, uncertain, unknowable provider, capital P, that has somehow changed favor over the years from once valuing heritage and authenticity to now favoring immigration and novelty and change. How have they lost our favor? The third component of white working class marginality is a sense of discrimination. They feel discriminated on the basis of being white and being poor. And they believe they are judged for it and lose jobs, housing, and are judged in intersocial, interpersonal relationships. So those are the three components in understanding their marginality. So now let's move on to those three questions. The first question, you recall, is this a transatlantic phenomenon that we're talking about right now? I certainly studied it transatlantically. But for many people, certainly in the United States, because everyone in the United States thinks that they're the first person to come up with anything. And if you read my American newspapers, they could be forgiven for that. It's very hard to find international news in the United States. Hi, Eric. Welcome aboard. This is our chair, Eric Kaufman. Thank you, Aiko. Eric, you're just in time to hear the three most important questions. So, is this a transatlantic phenomenon? I say yes. But let me tell you why some people think no. The demographic change that has been taking place across the Atlantic right now, people view it as different in the United States and Europe. America is this place, a country, an acknowledged country of immigration throughout its history. You can't understand America without seeing its inhabitants as immigrants, and they all see themselves as immigrants. You can't understand yourself as an American without knowing your own immigrant heritage. We're asked all the time, what's your family background? Where are you from? Right? And in Europe, countries are still not quite on board with the idea that they are countries of migration. They are viewed as countries of lineage, of blood, of people who have made sacrifices, contributing to the treasury, to wars abroad, to empires long lost. The second key difference between the two continents, I think, is how we understand class. In Britain, so much so, class is inherited. You are born into a class. Class is a birthright. And so even if you were born working class and you become quite wealthy, you're just a working class boy or girl who's done well for themselves. But in the United States, class is understood quite separately. Class is fluid. And hierarchies are made of cash. So people can move and intend to move through the hierarchy, through what is viewed as a meritocracy and the American dream, even though all the evidence about inequality and immobility in the United States says that it couldn't be less true. Americans are born into class almost as much as British people think they are born into their class, and they are just about as immobile when you look at the data today. So, how do we see a transatlantic phenomenon? Because the migration that has taken place in the United States is actually now being leapfrogged by much of what we see in Europe. A country like Switzerland is 25% foreign-born. The United States is a mere 13% foreign-born. Then if you think about, so the rate of immigration has really caught up. Then if you think about white working-class people, across the continents, there is only an understanding of 40 years of futility in the way they view their politics. 40 years of economic decline from a post-manufacturing economy, and politicians and political institutions have done very little to make it better from the perspective of white working-class people. But here's the clincher. The voting in and support for far-right parties. This is what has brought the continents truly together and made an undeniable transatlantic phenomenon. Now, in the continent, for 20 years, there's been the rise of far-right parties. Front National in France, you have the People's Party in Austria and Switzerland, the Freedom Party with Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, you have the Swedish Democrats, the True Finns, now the Alternative for Germany, Jobbik in Hungary. But what has been remarkable is that Britain and the United States, which were so protected by its electoral institutions, have not seen that same rise for a very long time because of that proportionate representation system I mentioned earlier. Britain and the United States have first passed the post system, single-member districts. It doesn't make sense to vote for a third party in our countries. Why? Because they're so unlikely to get any seats. And yet, in 2015, in the general election, UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, as I'm sure you know, received 13% of the national vote, yielding a mere one seat in Parliament. But 13% of Britain voted for them, and 27% of Britain voted for UKIP in the European elections beforehand. That's remarkable. People are so frustrated that they would rather vote for a party that they know can't win seats than to vote for the mainstream parties right now in so many places in Britain. And then, of course, UKIP took advantage of a unique situation when suddenly Britain became a proportionate democracy, a proportionate representation system, with the referendum called by Prime Minister Cameron. And the ringleader was able to lead Britain out of Europe, or so we think. But to really cap this off, Donald Trump infiltrates the Republican Party, calls himself a Republican, with a platform that no Republican in history would recognize as their own. And from within is able to twist the American political institutions, electoral institutions, into one of the most unexpected, extraordinary victories in the history of the United States. he is a radical right candidate. He is a far right candidate. And if you don't believe me, read Breitbart.com. Breitbart.com, Steve Bannon's website, his campaign manager, followed Trump's campaign before they were affiliated with it as alongside Progress for Front National in France, for Swedish Democrats, for the Freedom Party in Holland. They are birds of a feather. And so you have this transatlantic phenomenon. Second question. Is white working class angst just old-fashioned racism? I think it's a lot more complicated. Racism creates this duality where you're either a racist or you're not a racist. And so much of life, I think, is existing in between, in the gray. So I'm going to pose a few questions to you, and I'm not going to answer these questions because I'm not the racism referee. You can be. You're welcome to like nod or shake your head as you wish. It might be cathartic. But I want to demonstrate how difficult this can be sometimes. Is it racist to be against immigration because you associate it with a global system of commerce that has transformed your life? Second, is it racist to be against affirmative action programs that prioritize the admission or employment of people of color, or advocacy campaigns that prefer or that advocate on behalf of ethnic groups? Is it racist to think that white working class people are not well represented in the highest governing bodies and at the highest level of businesses? And just to inform your answer there, a recent book by my colleague from Duke University, Nick Carnes, just found that 2% of the American Congress is of working class background. Not white working class background, working class background. So it's even fewer for white working class background. When I spoke to white working class people, one of the most fascinating things that I heard, and this came from Barking and Dagenham in particular, was prefacing their statements to me by saying, "Now, I'm not racist, but dot, dot, dot." And of course, inside my head, I'm thinking, "Oh God, here it comes." And as I'm sure Dame Margaret can share, it will come. It came. I heard lots of things. Now, I'm not racist, but this whole borough is filled with blacks and Bosnians. Why Bosnians, I don't know, but I heard that. But I also heard things that were harder and far more complicated to classify. White working class people often spoke, in both continents, spoke about their plight in using the same terminology of the civil rights movement, about equality, about leveling the playing field, about racial justice, turning the tables of the civil rights movement. And yet, from their perspective, the tables have been turned on them. White working class people feel equally estranged from their ethnic minority neighbors as they do from their co-ethnic white people working in the city. They feel no connection to either group and are doubly alienated in their society and left to identify themselves without any sort of occupational identity. Rather, they are left with their whiteness. In the United States in particular, their whiteness is not even an American whiteness because it is this amalgamation of all white ethnicities that have come to the United States. Less so here in Britain. But when white people and white working class people are told, "Don't you benefit from the wages of whiteness, those invisible wages paid to you just on the virtue of your skin tone? Aren't you privileged by white privilege?" My white working class subjects say, "What privilege are you referring to? I am one car accident, one unexpected medical bill from being in that trailer park, from being thrown onto the street and losing everything. What wages are you referring to? For white working class people, the wages of whiteness are for them what the ocean is to fish. You don't know you're swimming in it because it's all you've ever had. All right, the third question. Why do white working class, what leads them, what drives them to support far-right parties and far-right candidates? So, full disclosure, this is a bit of a departure for me, this book. So I got into this by being a scholar of immigration, as Aiko could tell you. My first book was all about Muslim political behavior here in the United Kingdom and in Spain, speaking a little bit more broadly across Europe. And the reason why I wanted to study white people was because I studied the marginality of Muslims, and I asked myself, how much can we generalize about the marginality of people who are in disadvantaged states? And so I thought to study Muslims' primary antagonists. In fact, many immigrants' primary antagonists, to test this out. And what I found with Muslims is that what drove them to support radical parties, as in extremist groups, which I studied in some depth, was that they felt a sense of deprivation, largely political deprivation. They had an understanding of the way British society should be and their expectations. And their perceptions were that Britain fell short. And the wider that gap, the wider that discrepancy, the more likely they were to be extremists. So the question is that also true for white working class people, who are very different because they're born with a lot of those advantages that Muslims were lamenting in my work? And the answer is yes, but sort of. White working class people, I find, are subject to deprivation, but it's not a kind of deprivation about the way the world is and the way the world should be. It's about a deprivation between the way the world is and the way the world was. Their deprivation is about nostalgia. And so when I was in the field and when I conducted survey research, I asked my subjects, how financially well off would you say you are today? How financially well off were people like you 30 years ago? And I said people like you, by the way, because not all my subjects knew what was going on 30 years ago, like most of the people here. You were toddlers or maybe not born yet. I then asked, how much power do people like you have today? How much do politicians care about people like you today? How much power did you have? How much power did people like you have 30 years ago? How much did politicians care about you 30 years ago? And then I would present them with a set of concentric circles that I would draw on a little piece of paper, on a notepad. And I would draw four concentric circles, like a bullseye. And I said, imagine this is a model of your society. The most important people are central, they're in the middle. Most influential, they're there. And on each ring outward, people are less and less and less important. Where are you? I'd ask. Where were people like you 30 years ago? And then I would ask them, where are immigrants? Where are Muslims? Where are black people? Where are the elderly? Where are women? And they would place them. And what I found, particularly in Britain, is that those who were supporting UKIP were far more likely and associated with a very large discrepancy in power, but also in their social position. Those who were supporting UKIP tended to find themselves on the outer rings when they used to be more central. But what's so fascinating about the UK is that those same people tended to put immigrants and Muslims towards the center. They feel displaced. And in the United States, fascinatingly, power was also a really important factor that drove people to support Donald Trump, the Tea Party. But what was also fascinating is that the only outcome of interest to me that was driven by financial deprivation was support for Donald Trump. they thought that he, clearly, could make them rich again, to make them stable again, to make them whole again. And so we cannot understand this drive towards the radical right as anything outside of nostalgia. There is a desperate need to grasp the past because the future is so bleak. The only way to understand a post-traumatic future for my subjects was to reestablish a pre-traumatic past. I'll end there and look forward to comments.
Okay, I'm just going to turn it over to Stephen Kinnock, Labour MP for Aberavon.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Eric, and many thanks to you, Justin, for that compelling story, a truly brilliant analysis of where we are, and also, I think, very insightful on why we've got to where we are and where we need to try to go to, I guess, is something that we extrapolate from that. I thought it might be useful for my comments to build a little bit on what you've said, but particularly from a political point of view, given that I'm a politician, as is Margaret, and to talk a little bit about that. Maybe just to establish, you know, what my perspective on this would be, particularly from the point of view of the constituency I represent. And I have to say, it really underlines the view that this is a transatlantic phenomenon. I represent a constituency called Aberavon, and the main town in Aberavon is Portalbert. And Portalbert has the largest steelworks in the United Kingdom. And very much like Youngstown, it is a town that, you know, 20 years ago there were 20,000 men working in that steelworks. There are now about 3,000. And it's been a narrative of decline. Now, it hasn't been the kind of decline that you mentioned there. It doesn't sound as if Portalbert has in any way moved into the kind of dystopian picture that you painted of Youngstown, but it has had a very, very deep and negative impact on the town. And this is the process of deindustrialization and globalization and the technology revolution, which has driven massive change in our economy, had massive impact on our communities, and has left a white working class feeling that they've been left behind. The benefits of those driving trends have seemingly gone to a very small percentage of our population that increasingly seems to be based in and around London and the South East and perhaps some of the other urban centres in our country, and provincial towns like Portalbert, which is located between Cardiff and Swansea in South Wales. It's one of those caught in the middle towns, and you would, certainly the Rust Belt elements that you described of Youngstown, certainly some of that can be applied to the constituency I represent. It's got about 98% of the people in my constituency were born in the constituency or in South Wales. Very, very small percentage of immigrants. And, I mean, if you're English in Portalbert, you'd certainly be considered to be an immigrant. And 60% voted for Leave. So I think that demonstrates absolutely one of the most telling phrases in your presentation, I think, which was, in politics, perception is reality. And one of the huge mistakes that's been made in the debate about immigration in this country is that it's about dealing with the areas where there's been a very strong influx, a big inward flow of migration. Actually, that's not at all always the case. And if you map the results of the referendum, you'll see often the highest Leave vote is in the areas of lowest immigration. And so we've got to bear that in mind in terms of the perception of what this means, the fear, the need for reassurance. So in terms of that, once we've got that context, I was thinking of talking a bit about, you know, the politics of this, and particularly from the point of view of the Labour Party and this in my view, being the defining challenge for our party around what do we say to those who feel that they've been left behind, and what role does immigration play in this discourse around people feeling that they are going backwards rather than forwards in their lives. And I think that that's around three main strands, what I would call permission and policies, and then around the context of globalisation and the role of government in that context, and then specifically around the immigration question. In terms of permission and policies, I think that we have, as the Labour Party, have lost permission to be heard on this issue. And the reason that we've lost permission to be heard is, I think we've been obsessing for a long time. There's a number of reasons, partly about the discourse and also about what we've done on globalisation, but we've been obsessing, in terms of the discourse, about we've been obsessing about diversity. We have been a party that I think has been increasingly associated with standing up for certain groups in our society and not standing up for all in our society. And the huge mistake we've made, I think, is we've played the game of identity politics and identified groups, whether it's by ethnicity or by sexuality or whatever you might want to call it, rather than say, we stand up for everyone in this country. And that includes you, the white working class in Port Talbot, who feel desperately disempowered and left behind, both by our economy and by our politics. And I think that for me, was thrown into sharp relief, again, underlining why this is a transatlantic phenomenon, in the presidential elections, where it felt to me that Hillary Clinton, every time she went on the stump, she put a shout out to the Latino community, to the Afro-Caribbean community, to a whole range of other groups that she was identifying. That's fine if you're going to do that, but if you're going to do that, you better make sure you list off every single group in your population, because if you don't, the results will be very clear at the ballot box. So I think what we need to see on the progressive left in our country and elsewhere is an end to this identity politics. We need to be talking far more about commonality rather than what differentiates us from each other. Let's talk about what unites us. And what we find is that every group is actually struggling with the same problems of social mobility, the same problems of disempowerment, the same problems of feeling that they're being left behind. It doesn't matter what the colour of your skin is or what your background is. What matters is that you're poor and you're disadvantaged. And we've got to be there to help and engage with every single one of you, not just those who seem to have been taken priority over others. So I think there's a fundamental challenge for Labour there, but I think there's an opportunity as well, because what we know is that the populists, what they will do is channel anger and suspicion and fear, but they won't necessarily look for solutions, and the solutions that they do try to bring forward will be very, very counterproductive in my view, and that's an opportunity for us to take that forward and engage with that. So I think there's something around the narrative and the discourse that we have to get right in our own minds before we can even win permission to be heard. I think there's also another fundamental question we have to ask ourselves about globalization. And I think for too long, we've operated on the assumption that the primary role of government is about advancing globalization. And I think the big shift is we've got to move to a mindset which is far more saying the primary role of government is to deliver prosperity whilst managing the deeply disruptive impacts of globalization. So it's got to be, rather than an entirely orthodox, if you like, in terms of certainly what we've seen with the neoliberal consensus for much of the last 20 or 30 years, It is saying globalization is a reality. You can't be against it. It's like being against bad weather. It's going to come. It's happening. You can't sit there like King Canute on the beach and try and hold the waves back in and hope that that will happen. You've got to accept it's coming. But you must also be clear that there are deeply damaging impacts of globalization, and the role of government is to mitigate that. And I think that that has two strands to it. One is clearly on the economy, and one is around immigration. On the economy, Donald Trump seems to think that you can manage the impact of immigration by taking more protectionist trade policies, and I think it's going to be very important to point out that it's far more fundamental than that. We need a deep-seated rebalancing of the British economy, for example. We've seen a massive decline in our manufacturing sector. In the 1970s, 30% of British GDP was in manufacturing. It's now down to about 10%, whereas in Germany, you've seen manufacturing holding pretty steady at around 25% of their GDP all the way through. So these are not inevitable consequences of globalization. These are failures of policy, failures of successive governments to develop and deliver a more balanced economy. So there's a huge amount we need to do there, and it's not just about, it's not the old metal bashing, and it's not the old days of the steelworks are never going to come back. We're not talking about reinstituting monolithic industries here. We're talking about shifting to a modern manufacturing renaissance based on whatever it might be, from 3D printing to increasing investment in research and development to green energy and infrastructure. So there's a huge need to shift to what I would call a Marshall Plan for the 21st century for our economy, because that's the only way you're really going to start putting some of the economic growth back into areas of the country where it's so desperately needed. And the second strand on this is around immigration. And I think that it's critical now for the Labour Party to come out and say, we want to build a country that it has our values of compassion, of solidarity, of cohesive communities. We are not going to be able to do that unless we demonstrate to people that we understand that the role of the state is to manage immigration. Just as it's the role of the state to manage our health service, our education, our transport, our infrastructure, it must also be the role of the state to manage the immigration process. And that feeds in very much to our view that the role of the state is to mitigate the impact of globalization. So I think it's actually about having a values-based approach to defining our approach to immigration. For too long, the Labour Party has looked like a party that was only talking in a different way about immigration because a focus group had told us to, and people will see through that immediately. So we actually need to look at the roots of why we understand and the need for government to play a role in rebalancing our economy. And a big part of that rebalancing is dealing with the issue of immigration, because, as Justin so rightly pointed out, until you've won permission, people's permission to be heard, until you've shown them that you want to build the values that you hold and dear to, you hold to and cherish, and that the only way to do that is to provide people with the reassurance that they need that you understand where you're coming from and what needs to be managed, that's the only way in which you're going to be able to engage in this debate and change the terms of the debate. So I think we need to understand what we need to do to get permission to be heard. We need the right policies and to be put in place, but those policies have to be rooted in our values as a progressive left of centre party.
I'll move to Dame Margaret Hodge, MP for Barking, and also an LSE alumnus.
I am indeed. I'm going to have my observations on Justin, really, from my experience as the MP for Barking. So, and just share some thoughts with you So it's really, and what they've led me to think about, and perhaps it can stimulate a bit of a debate. And thank you, Justin, for and Stephen for really stimulating contribution so far. So I got to Barking in 1994. I became the MP for Barking, having worked for 20 years, always lived in, mostly lived in, I'm an immigrant, but mostly lived in my adult life in inner London, in what was a multiracial community. When I came out of the station in Barking, when I first was trying to be selected as their candidate for MP, the thing that absolutely hit me was how white it was. And as I got to know the people of Barking and Dagenham, what was also astounding to me was how many great-grandmothers lived within 10 minutes walking distance of their great-grandchildren. So what there was a very close East End white community. Now, we didn't start collecting data on ethnicity until the 1991 census. And I'll just give you two figures. In 1991, the percentage of white people in Barking and Dagenham was 93.2%. 20 years on, in 2011, mere 20 years, that had dropped to 58.3%. So there was a massive, very rapid change in the nature of the population in Barking and Dagenham. And I think when people say, how do people respond to that? If you are living in a community where suddenly your neighbours change, or the food that is sold in the shops change, or the faces in the playground change, that is bound to make you feel unsettled and insecure. And I think it's an arrogance of the middle classes who don't experience this change that we don't understand the response to that change. That's my first really important... So the fear, the hostility to change is something we would all feel, and something that certainly the people of Barking, Dagenham, very unlike Stephen's constituency, felt. It was partly because of... I just want to add to the analysis, really, that Justin had. It was partly because of deindustrialisation. But most important for me was housing policy, actually, because Barking Dagenham was basically one great big council estate built to house the workers of Ford's. And then along comes Right to Buy in 1983 under Mrs Thatcher, and that privatised the housing stock. And that privatisation of the housing stock led not just to people buying and moving on, and they then sold, because it's the cheapest part of Greater London. It's the only borough in the whole of Greater London where there isn't a house over £1 million today. So as people sort of bought and sold on, they sold to sort of second-generation immigrants, often from Caribbean African communities, who were trying to get their foot on the first step of the housing ladder, or they bought, moved out, and let. And buy-to-let has been the most destructive policy for community integration that I have come across in all my work in as a public servant over the years. Because what then happened was they were let very often to inner London, hard-pressed inner London councils, who overfilled them. And with people who came in, temporary accommodation, no commitment to the local community, and came in and changed what had been a very stable East End community. And you just can't underplay that. I mean, today it's still where it's not let to a local authority. It is over. You get too many people in a multi-occupied house. You don't get nobody caring about the garden. You get nobody contributing to the local community. All those bits that keep a community coherent is very important. And I think housing was as important to me as the deindustrialization and the change in jobs. The other thing, so that's the first thing I wanted to say, and that created huge... And those, just to say this, those most people who could bought and moved out. Those, a lot of the white working class community who are there today are the ones who couldn't buy and couldn't move out. So that their feeling of alienation and change and wanting to put the clock back to the 1950s was sort of strengthened by the fact that actually even within the working class community, they were the poorest and they were the most left behind and they had no choices to them. In 2006, 12 BMP councillors were elected to Barking and Dagenham Council. And I'd say that because it puts me to another element in this, because I think politics and politicians have a lot to blame for culpable in a lot of ways in not understanding. It's not about, I don't feel it's about permission, but it's not listening and understanding what people were feeling in their local community. So I had a moribund Labour Party. It was full of white, middle-aged men, mostly who'd come in through the trade union movement, most of whom, they used to count weighing the votes in, very few. When I first arrived in 1994, the leader of the council, who had been a member of the Labour Party since the League of Youth, had never knocked on a door in Barking and Dagenham because he didn't feel he had to. It was a very inward-looking Tammany Hall sort of politics. So when people were experiencing change, couldn't access housing, losing their jobs, feeling the growing inequality, there was no political presence to respond to that. And I'm part of that. I mean, I noticed it first actually before in 2001 when I had a very low turnout. And what I did some qualitative research at that time on a very rundown council estate in the borough. And what people were saying to me is they weren't apathetic. It wasn't that they didn't turn out because they were apathetic. They didn't turn out because they were angry. They were angry with us because we weren't listening and responding to their needs. So I think lack of the way we do our politics is a lot of the reason why people then get alienated from the mainstream and move to the extremes in the political spectrum. I completely changed in 2006 how I do my politics. So I stopped doing things like going to Labour Party meetings endlessly. I stopped spending my time cutting ribbons at events. And everything I did had to help me reconnect with local people. So it was very much about communicating with people, listening to them, acting on what I could. And I couldn't act on immigration. I want to come back to that, which was the thing that was driving them mad, and the lack of housing. I couldn't act on that, but I could act on very local issues. And by listening, communicating, responding where I could to it, whether it was a bit of prostitution locally, the sighting of a bus stop, mess in the street, they felt I was beginning to listen, and I could build trust again through that mechanism, and I responded. And I think doing one's politics in a different way is very important. The other thing is, politicians, it's not that we refuse to talk about immigration. When I first started talking about these issues in about 2007, 2008, I got absolutely lambasted by the Labour Party and lambasted by a lot of people who said I was giving oxygen to the extreme right, which I think was very mistaken. But we always promise things that we can't deliver on immigration. That's really where we go wrong. So we promise we'll cut numbers where we can't. And whether it's a right-wing Conservative government or a left-wing Labour government, everybody talks about controlling numbers when we can't do it, because migration is, of course, a feature of the globalisation that we're talking about. And thinking that you can close your borders to that migration is a nonsense. So we ought to stop actually promising what we can't, including the present Conservative government, as it is doing, and all those who promoted Brexit, and start talking honestly about migration. And what I have found with my community locally, be it white working class or others, is that actually if you have... Well, I'm going to come back to 2016, but this was between 2006 and 2010. I always said, I'm not going to stop the change. I'm not going to turn the clock back to the 1950s white, all white, very closed East End community. But I'm going to try and make it work for you. And it's actually listening to where they felt the unfairness and inequities grew from migration. If you could respond to that, that was much more important. So it was about having a little bit of time spent in a community before you were entitled to the allocation of public resources that always have to be rationed, be it housing or be it other public services. Now, that again was an anathema, especially to the left, because we've always allocated according to need. We've never given recognition. That's been our priority. And you can understand why, and instinctively I go with that. But but actually listening to people who feel it's not fair that somebody's got a house before I've got mine, although they've only been here for a few years, whereas I've been here for three or four generations. Listening to that, responding to that, again, I think is an appropriate response to people's fears about migration. Promising numbers when you can't deliver, I think, is an inappropriate response to migration. Can I also say that it's a lot of people, this is a very, very complicated issue. So Barking and Dagenham, I first noticed the migrants coming in from Kosovo. It was the Kosovans who were housed in Barking and Dagenham by Westminster Council in whenever that was, 97, 98, that was really, for me, the start of a new community. When was Kosovo? It was about that time, wasn't it?
95.
So that was the start of me noticing the change. But every community that comes in then resents the next intake of migrants, and that came home to me so much in the 2015 election. I'll tell you this story. So Eastern Europeans don't participate in elections. One hates to stereotype, but it's much more difficult encouraging them to vote. And I was on the doorstep trying to encourage this Lithuanian family that they really had to vote to keep UKIP out. I spent 10 minutes with this guy on the doorstep. Finally, I persuaded him that he would come out and vote. And then he said, but you've got to do one thing for me, Margaret. And I thought, okay, let's listen to what he wants. And he said this seriously. So I said, go on, what is it? He said, you've got to stop these Romanians coming in. And if you think it's that generation, let me tell you about my experience with a year 10 group in one of my secondary schools, where I go in and I try and encourage again social cohesion by talking to these kids. So this is year 10, who had experienced nothing but a multiracial Barking and Dagenham. And this one little kid gets up and says to me, problem is, Mrs. Odge, you've let all these immigrants in. It's really terrible. You've ruined the borough. And the deputy head teacher says to him, tell Mrs. Hodge what your surname is and tell her where you were born. And he himself was an immigrant. So it's just to show you that this is not, and that's clearly passed on through his parents, this is a very, very much more complex situation. The other thing I wanted to say, two other things. One is that I worked really hard with others. One of my councillors is here, and between 2006 and 2010, we put massive effort into reconnecting with our local community, and we succeeded. In 2010, we saw off the BNP. I saw off Nick Griffin in a real challenge to me, and the council was, we got all the BNP councillors off. I then came to the Brexit debate, and I hadn't changed the way I worked from 2000. So it's all about reconnection, it's all about listening, it's all about responding, it's all about trying to engage in an honest conversation on immigration. What I noticed in the run-up to the Brexit vote was that people were no longer listening to me when I talked about immigration. And this is really scary, and I haven't thought about how to respond to all this. Because they have been given permission by those pro-Brexiteers, political leaders, to express and feel an anti-immigration sort of value that, in a sense, they hadn't expressed or felt before. It's unleashed something which is pretty uncontrollable at the moment and pretty scary. And what I've had a lot of since the Brexit vote is this, I've got our country back. Now, however much I said to them, it's not going to change the pattern of migration in Barking and Dagenham. It's not going to change. It's not going to put Barking and Dagenham back to where we were in the 1950s. In the post-truth society, nobody believes me. And I feel a very, very different environment today, and a much scarier environment, which I think is much tougher for us to tackle as a political class. My final thing is about immigration and racism and the complication of that. And I think when I was fighting Griffin and the BNP in that 2006 to 2010, I always said nobody's being racist. It's because their community has changed. and they're coping with that change is bound to, and coping with the useless Labour Party as we were then, we're wonderful now, of course, locally. we are locally.
Oh, okay, sorry, yes.
coping with all that it was completely understandable. I now sort of worry that we shouldn't just look at the symptoms, but we have to go underneath to the causes. And whilst the symptoms may be economic inequality, lack of access to housing, lack of resources for schools and hospitals and all those things, that income inequality in our society, I worry and that there is actually a real racist undercurrent which is much wider and stronger than we thought. And I worry about whether, if we refuse to call it out, whether we can, in those circumstances, really tackle the growth in the extreme right, whether it's nationally or internationally, with an appropriate response. Because if you always think it's the core, it's the symptoms, lack of public services, rather than the causes underneath. It's not that it's the only cause, but I think it's much more present than we like to admit. And I'm worried if we don't call it out, we may not build that sort of social cohesion that is so intrinsic to certainly Stephen and my values as members of the Labour Party. Now, I don't have an answer to that, but in the post-Brexit scenario, I think that my inability to communicate in the way I was able to before, the permission given by leading politicians to express real hostility to immigration and that underlying racism which we haven't dared call out are really worrying things that we all have to think about.
You've been very patient. We're going to take questions in batches of three. Short questions, no comments, and please tell us your affiliation. So we'll start down here. We have a question.
There's a mic.
The mic's, yeah.
Thank you. I'm Sewell Chan with the New York Times. Justin, in your really informative talk, you didn't speak. One area you didn't speak as much on was your respondents' attitudes towards public policy. Did they actually investigate what Clinton and Trump were actually promising in terms of things like tax policy, fiscal policy, higher education, healthcare, etc.?
Okay, there's another question here in the front row.
Susan Wolf, I'm a social historian and I love these public events. Back in 1972, as a very young woman living in London, my flatmate friend invited her flatmate's friend's grandmother, who lived for generations in the same row house in the East End, invited us for tea one Sunday afternoon before Christmas. And that was the day that I felt something was seriously changing and wondered what the long-term effects would be. She'd been living in the same row house for generations, and up through her kitchen drain on a quiet Sunday, the reggae music from the Jamaican neighbors came pouring into her flat. She couldn't do anything about it. It dominated our conversation because we couldn't hear ourselves talk. And that felt like a moment. Was I wrong?
Okay, we'll just take one more over here. Young man with a gray sweatshirt.
Hi, Matteo Tiritelli. I'm from the University of Manchester. You spoke about the death of the centre and the rise of the far right, and about the way that the sort of narrative of immigration and the emotional effects that narrative have sort of taken on a life of its own. And I wonder if part of the rise of the far right and of that narrative, independent of the sort of facts of immigration in whatever area you happen to live in, I wonder if part of that shift to the right has been because the center shifted to the right, thinking particularly about Clinton and Blair and the sort of grand left-right coalitions that have taken many of the proportional representative democracies in Europe.
Okay, who wants to handle those? Why don't we start? Well, I'll start with you, Justin, why don't we?
Okay, I'm going to keep my answers short, and it's not because I'm being dismissive, but I know that there's a lot of other people who want to ask, so I'll be quick. With policy, there are three kinds of Donald Trump voters. Either they voted for him because they agree with all of his policies, and they're, you know, a fan, right? They think that he's right and that he's going to do good things. The second group are people who hate Hillary and couldn't stand her so much that they'd rather just see Trump go in. And then there's a third group that basically did not see Donald Trump as someone who was going to bring better policies. They saw him as someone who was going to drain the swamp, who's going to shake Washington up, who's going to flip up a middle finger to Washington, and they voted for him for symbolic reasons, completely independent of his policies. And so for many of those voters, and those are many of them in the Midwest of the United States who I interviewed, the policies were beside the point. They had heard policy suggestions from Democrats, from Republicans for 40 years. They voted for both sides. None of them did anything good for them. They were poorer off as a result. And from their perspective, the recession of 2008 was really a recession that dated back to 1978. So policies to them were irrelevant. So thanks for that question. With regard to the center shifting, you know, in some ways that's kind of what I'm saying, isn't it, right? Because when the people who were in the center move to the fringe, they can drag the center with them when you are perhaps a minority, but really a plurality of the electorate. This is a very large constituency, which is why I did not predict Trump winning. Okay, so let me just be very clear. A lot of people are asking me for lottery numbers right now. Okay, I did not predict that Trump would win. I was looking at the same polls as all of you. But what I did know is that this was a very underestimated group of people who had enormous electoral potential when, depending on how you define white working class, they represent a minimum of 33% of the United States and really a minimum of 60% of Britain. So this is a very large group of people involved, so it's a good question. With regard to reggae music, so this is... I'm going to use your question as a foil because I wanted to complicate what I said about, now I'm not racist, but... Okay, but there's reggae music coming from upstairs. So what I want to explain is that when people said, now I'm not racist, but it wasn't that they had sensitivity training and were trying to, you know, I want to be tolerant here. No, the reason that they were saying this is that they view racism, and this is the admonishment that I would give to my colleagues to my left here, is that when we talk about racism and alleged racism, the way white working class people understand racism is as a label that gets smacked over their mouth and tells them that what you're about to say is invalidated and disqualified because you're a racist. So what you say doesn't matter. Don't listen to him. He's a racist. Doesn't matter. You know, it's irrelevant. So they view it as what I call a mute button. It is a mute button. You hit the racist button, and that means what everyone's about to say stops mattering. And they view the left as complicit in stamping on this mute button anytime white working class people have something to say. And it's not to deny that racism doesn't infuse what's going on. As I mentioned, racism is the water surrounding the fish. But it's nevertheless something that politically is untenable for politicians to do precisely for that reason. Racism has left, it's lost its roots as a concept that's meaningful and powerful to demonstrate prejudice and bias, and has instead become something that it was never intended to be.
Margaret?
I agree that we never allowed a conversation about immigration. What is scary, though, I also agree with Justin about this issue that anybody who dared to talk about immigration or concerns about changes in their community felt themselves labelled as racist. But equally, I think what you've then got to move forward to, Justin, is what's happened now, whether it's Trump or whether it's here with the Brexit campaigners, that the way in which they opened the conversation on immigration and allowed that conversation to take place has unleashed something with which I'm really uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
And it's not a, you know, change, or it's not legitimate concerns about immigration. It is what I think is racism. And just out of interest, I'm Jewish. I'm a Jewish immigrant. All the time I was fighting Nick Griffin and the BNP, I never had any overt racism, anti-Semitism, interesting enough. I had a little bit on election day when one of the BNP councillors said to me, go back to Germany, and I said I couldn't because they'd killed all my relatives. But that was all. In the last year or so, I've had to put three emails I've had to the police because they were so anti-Semitic. It's really interesting how that has changed. And that's been my own very personal experience. Then I want to go to this. I want to deal with a cultural issue because I've been thinking about that an awful lot. And I don't know if I'm wrong about this, but when I was sort of in inner London and I was active in local government. And there, we were a very multiracial, multicultural, we used that term in those days, multicultural community. But I didn't see lots of hijabs around the place. And suddenly that has changed, and the new generation, many of whom are British-born, of Asian heritage, now feel they have to define their identity in very visible ways. It's not just the women, it's the men as well. So that is a change, and I think we should think about that, because what does that do for social integration? How can that work in a community where we want to build social integration? The other thing I was going to say is the reggae music is very interesting, because what a lot of people say to me is, I can't stand those black churches. They make so much ruddy noise on a Sunday that we can't...
They call them happy, clappy churches.
Yeah,
that's
happy,
what they're
called. That's right. So they criticise that. They then say to me, and Fridays in the mosque is terrible because you hear the noise, you hear the praying all the time, and I can't park my car. Nobody ever says to me, I object to the church bells on a Sunday.
Smells like meat pie. No one says that, but they do say it smells like curry.
So there's a very interesting way in which people are expressing cultural differences. Now, again, I haven't got an answer to any of this. All I can do is sort of observe it and think, if we don't start thinking about these very difficult issues about cultural identity, and certainly a greater need today to actually define your cultural identity in very visible ways. What that does to an acceptance of migration and changing communities, I think is a really tough agenda that you have to think about and that we as politicians need to also address.
I think on what's happened to the centre, one of the fascinating things about immigration is it's probably the one issue on the planet, actually, that unites Tony Blair with Jeremy Corbyn, but for very different reasons. Jeremy Corbyn and his wing of the Labour Party will not talk about immigration because talking about immigration means you're a racist. The more, if you like, Blairite wing of the party will simply talk about the huge benefits of immigration from an economic point of view as part of the embrace of globalization. In my view, both of those directions are wrong and go a long way to explain why the Labour Party has ceded so much ground in politics in the last years, and why, you know, certainly goes a long way to explain why UKIP secured 4 million votes in the last election. So the right answer for us as a party has to be somewhere between those two. You know, there was that extremely memorable moment in the 2010 election campaign when Gordon Brown was confronted with that woman by that woman, Gillian Duffy, who was raising concerns about immigration. He was overheard on the microphone afterwards calling her a bigot. And that has massive impact in the British electorate and is not the right way to be dealing with this issue. So I think, you know, clearly there is a shift of the centre. The right is dragging the centre, but that's because the centre has allowed it to happen. Mm. And we have been trying for years and years and years to convince people of the economic benefits of migration. And it's clear they're there. There's no doubt at all that people who come here to work, they tend to be young, fit, healthy, they're keen to work. They deliver far more to the exchequer in the taxes they pay than what they take out in terms of taking from the welfare state. But nobody is listening to that. And we need to wake up to the fact that nobody's listening to it. You can go on and on and on about benefits to the economy. Look at the impact of the referendum campaign, where the Remain campaign tried to say leaving the EU will be really bad for the British economy. And people said to me, when I was out knocking doors in that campaign, they said, well, it might be bad for the British economy, but it won't make any difference to my economy. And that's the fundamental difference. We've been talking in abstracts, and it's because the economy has benefited a small proportion of the population, and everybody else is being left behind, or certainly the people we're talking about this evening. So that's why the centre has lost ground. It's allowed it to happen because it's been talking in the wrong way about these issues. In terms of public policy, I think that absolutely comes back to the point about what actually is happening in our economy and what's the difference between the economy and my economy. And when we find a narrative that bridges that gap, we will be onto something. Trump is trying to do that. He did it extremely well because he said, this is what's happening in your economy. I understand what's happening in your economy. Forget about the economy that's been defined by the Washington consensus. This is about what's happening in your life. The thing is, though, he has absolutely no solutions, and I think that will be that's what happens when populists take over. They actually have to take responsibility, and they haven't got a clue what they're doing. In terms of this thing on Reggae, it's the same issue, really, I think, which is about saying perception is reality, and whatever is happening, broadly speaking, and it's clear that our country is not being taken over by a bunch of Bob Marley disciples.
Wish it were.
If you're in that living room and you're hearing that music blasting through, that is what it feels like. So it's about how do we help to get that bigger picture, what's really happening out there, but always relating it to the reality of people's lives.
Thanks very much. We'd love to take more questions. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. What I will say, however, is that Justin's fantastic book, which I have read and very much recommend, is available, and the website that it's available on is called The New Minority, all one word, .net, so please do check it out. I'd like to thank our speakers.
It's also
and all
on
of
Amazon.
You. Also on Amazon.
And in all good bookstores.
And I'd like to Oxford. Thank our speakers and all of you for coming.